Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you want to download it and play it on your iPod, iPad, any device, computer, etc. Today we have a real interesting show as we have Scott Carlson from Seifert and Shaw on the show. And Scott and I met way back, I think, early on in both our eDiscovery careers in San Francisco back in 2005 in what was one of Scott's first national eDiscovery conferences. He's done so many more since then. And it was the show where I actually created the 4C eDiscovery wine in response to the 3Cs in Zuba Lake, which are communicate, coordinate, and comply. Since that time, Scott has developed a reputation as one of the top eDiscovery consultants in the field. He founded and co-chairs Seifert and Shaw's eDiscovery practice and is really he's nationally known in the area of eDiscovery. His practice is entirely devoted to eDiscovery and high technology issues from both consulting and a litigation perspective. He teaches a Master's of Law course on the subjects of eDiscovery, digital evidence, and computer forensics. Scott brings us really strong technical background to his practice. He's got a BS in computer science and mathematics and experience working in private industry as a software engineer. He's represented clients in a myriad of issues related to eDiscovery and high-tech matters, including electronic document preservation, production, spoliation, and computer forensics. He represents and provides eDiscovery advice to a broad range of clients from small and mid-sized companies up to the nation's largest companies. A unique aspect of Scott's background, and I'm sure the topic of a future show, is he's a certified Six Sigma Green Belt. Using Lean Six Sigma and project management methodologies has resulted in an approach his firm calls the CFARF Lean approach, which delivers increased value to clients at a time of increased market pressures and competitive demands. This has been, it's really great to finally have you on a show here, Scott, so thanks for joining us.
Sure, glad to do it.
Okay, well, I always like to start my program by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery. Was it the 4C wine I pitched in San Francisco or something else?
I think it was a historical accident. I had that background with computer science and math and software engineer, and I always sort of looked for ways, and I started out the firm as a first-year associate. I've been at Seifert the whole time. And I really was always looking for ways that technology sort of fit into my practice. And I did some software licensing work, wasn't that excited about it. I did some, dabbled in some trademark and copyright, different things. Nothing really excited me. I didn't really think patent law was really where I wanted to go. And then as a sort of senior associate, young income partner, people knew I was fairly technical and started calling me about things that really what today we'd call e-discovery that I'm not sure we had completely adopted the term back then. And so I started getting involved in, forensic examinations of hard drives and things like that. And for me, frankly, it finally found the right niche for me to combine my technical interests along with the litigation interests. So I just happened to hit the time at timing right, I guess.
Boy, we're going to use the Goldilocks theme later on in this, but it sounds like the Three Bears in Scott's career.
<That's>
so
<right.
laughs> anyway, let's talk about the topic, the correlation between client risk tolerance and e-discovery readiness. So, how does risk assessment from your experiences play a role in the e-discovery readiness of clients?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I did some tort work and early on in my practice before I shifted to commercial and other things, and I'm always sort of stuck on this notion of reasonableness, which permeates most of e-discovery, and so I cringe when I hear the words, how do we become e-discovery compliant? Because there's just not a checklist out there that we can say you're compliant. So it really comes down, like any reasonableness sort of standard, is it's risk-based. And it says, okay, it's all on a scale here, and, what is our tolerance to risk as a client, and where are we going to fall on the continuum? So just like the early days of tort, when people would say, well, was that condition safe? Well, it's not that something is on off, it's safe or not safe. There's sort of varying levels. It's things can get safer and less safe, but there's not really some gold standard that says, yeah, this is safe. And I think e-discovery is the same way. It's not that you're suddenly compliant. It's all in this sort of shades of gray about how do we handle risk, what's our tolerance for risk, and how is that going to play out in how we tackle sort of the e-discovery reasonableness question.
My sense is this really probably differs across the board between different types of organizations.
No, yeah, that's absolutely right, Carl. I mean, I think you've got I'll just give you some sort of examples. Obviously, let's say you're an e-discovery vendor. Probably the notion of e-discovery sanction is not that exciting to you. So I think most e-discovery vendors in handling their own matters would want to be, very, very low risk and very conservative. On the other hand, you know, if you're running a company that no one really knows your name and you don't have a high litigation profile, if I run a meatpacking plant somewhere and nobody has a label of, Scott's Meatpacking on there, I don't have a lot of recognition of my brand. Maybe I have very little litigation. Meatpacking is probably a bad example there because I'm sure there's plenty of food contamination claims. But it's
illegal immigration.
Food contamination. So I think it just depends on where you want to go. And I have one client said to me, picture that show on the Nature Channels with the herd, and there's the folks that run the front of the herd, the folks that are behind the herd, and the ones that are in the middle. I want to be in the middle because I don't want to get picked off by the wolf in the back, and I really don't want to be setting any records for the front end either. So I think it's all where are you on that continuum and what risks you're willing to take.
So what types of actions do you see from companies who are risk-averse regarding e-discovery?
I think a lot of it comes down to control. The ones that are more risk-averse try to control more of the process. Doesn't necessarily mean they internalize it, but they're thoughtful about it. They try to understand where the risks all lie, and then they try to control those risks, whether it be through outside counsel or internal mechanisms, but they've really tried to look at the process and say, okay, these are the risk points, and let's see how we're going to deal with those. I think that's really where you see it.
Well, let's talk about, we could use the running of the herd example or Goldilocks here, but let's talk about the different components of an e-discovery project and how risk-averse or just feeling lucky can impact how a company approaches e-discovery. And let's start, first with, at the beginning, records management and having e-discovery plan in place and go between the feeling lucky company at the back, the medium approach, or the risk-averse at the front, how they approach records management or having e-discovery plan in place.
Yeah, I think we saw even early on in the, certainly pharmaceutical in the earliest days, even back in 05, and 06, that pharmaceutical was sort of way ahead, I think, viewed in really developing internal processes, developing internal policies. And I think that would, be what you'd call sort of the more risk-averse folks. And part of why they were driven there is because of the high volumes of litigation and the high stakes. So, risk-based decision, let's figure out how we're going to do this, and let's internalize a lot. I think, on the other end, let's face facts, there are a whole lot of companies that don't have an internal e-discovery policy, even after all this time. And a lot don't have internal processes, some for good reason, some because they just don't face much litigation. If I had a client come to me and say, we get sued once every couple of years, we have a couple of work comp claims, but largely we don't have a lot going on, maybe some low-risk stuff. I'm not sure I'd tell that client that they need to go out and establish some detailed e-discovery policy and preservation strategy. I'm not sure. I think you can handle that in the nature of a fire drill. On the other hand, if you face thousands of suits and you have trouble even keeping track of how much litigation you have, then I think you have a whole different approach. And somewhere in the middle is, some approach to handle the normal types of cases you have. And we've had some clients that will, try to come up with, okay, let's do a policy that covers, the 80% that we expect to happen. And in the really crazy stuff, part of that's going to be fire drill oriented, and we're just going to have to invest the resources when those things come up. But we're not going to develop a whole policy around the worst case scenario.
Okay. And the next step is, now you anticipate litigation. You've got a collection and a legal hold letter. How does that break down between the three participants we've identified?
Yeah, I think we'll break those down. So legal hold has been an interesting one because there's some very sophisticated products out there. Years ago there were just a handful, and now there's a variety of products you can use to manage litigation hold, some of them much, much more sophisticated than others. But I think, still we've got some clients that have internalized and brought in a system to manage their legal holds. And that's the right thing for some clients, and the more risk-averse clients, certainly. And again, the volume decision, things like that, where you want to go ahead and internalize and have an automated process. On the other hand, in the less risk or more risk-averse or less risk-averse group, they're still running the spreadsheets. They're still manually sending emails around with litigation holds. It's a very manual process. And then in the middle, there's some of these other sort of add-on products to certain tools and other sort of lower-end legal hold management tools. So, it just depends on what makes sense, and obviously dollars drive those decisions too. And like any decision a company makes about spending money, it's the question is, what's our return on investment? And if you have a lot at risk, then you're willing to spend more than if you don't have much at risk. On the collection front, I think it's a similar notion. There's lots of there's a variety of different collection tools out there, some enterprise-wide, some more machine-by-machine approaches. And I think depending on, the real risk-averse client will, with a good litigation profile, that or a bad litigation profile, I guess, depending on how you look at it.
You're the lawyer and you just came out.
That's right, exactly. With a bad litigation profile that has a lot of cases, well, they're going to seriously think about internalizing that IT capability to collect. And so they may consider a collection tool enterprise-wide. They may consider a indexing tool to get at their data quicker. On the other hand, if you're on the other end of the world, you're going to have IT tools that are designed for whatever you do in your business and not give much thought to how they might be used in terms of a e-discovery collection and preservation. So you're all over the place in there. And again, also how manual you want to be, how automated. And we get a little different mix on the risk side, too, that plays in more than just volume and besides volume and automation and litigation risk profile, there's another factor I see that pops into the collection piece, and that is sensitivity of the data. So an organization that has really very sensitive data that they just really don't want a vendor to come in and collect, they're not very comfortable with it leaving the four walls, those people will also be driven based more on the sensitivity of the data than on the litigation risk profile. So I'll sometimes see that as well.
Okay. The next stage then is the processing the data for review, and you can also include in that step the approach of culling down data based on dates, keywords, custodians.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because I suppose depending on the vendor you choose, it may be more risk averse to outsource than insource. So there's plenty of the missteps, I guess, that can happen in processing. I think are just as likely to happen to you when you internalize processing as they are when you rely on a vendor. It's the processing step is about good process. It's about good project management. It's about repeatability. It's about the right technology tools. And people who have a lot of experience with it do it well. And people who have less experience with it have the potential to not do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, so when a company says, well, wouldn't it be better if I just brought it all in-house? I don't know. It depends. If you're willing to commit to it and you're willing to try to replicate what the outside market does and you're committed to doing it well and have the kind of environment that allow you to change and reinvest and do things, then I think bringing it internally can be a great risk mitigator. On the other hand, sending it out may be your best choice. And then, of course, especially with the economy, we've seen contraction in the vendor market. We've seen, through the years, we've seen a lot of activity of people moving around company to company even before the economy sort of went bad. So the external is not risk-free, even with some experienced vendors. So that's a tough one. It's. I think there's not a clear answer to what's more risk-averse when it comes to processing and culling and things. And I guess another component I'd add to that is, what about the new technology, the new stuff, the latest and greatest hot thing? Is that more risk-averse to take on the leading-edge stuff, or is it less risk-averse? I don't know. It depends. I mean, it might be less costly. You may have some real cost-saving measures. But everybody's sometimes hesitant to jump in. I mean, somebody used this analogy with me the other day about something where they said, picture that scene in on the South Pole with all the penguins standing along, thousands of penguins standing on the edge, and nobody moves to jump in the water until one goes, and then the second one, and then all of a sudden all of them go. And I think we face that sometimes with new technology need discovery as well.
Yeah, I agree. And processing is a lot like the Star Trek where you have Scotty back there trying to keep the ship together. It's ugly. It's not a pretty part of e-discovery.
Well, and I think there's a lack of standards, really. I mean, people are sometimes surprised. And we get less of this now, but back even a few years ago when, different processing companies would just sort of pick the metadata that they thought was important. And maybe they'd process 12 fields or 20 fields. You can't blame them. There were no standards. And today, really, there's still no standards in exactly what processing means. I don't think the lawyers were giving them a whole lot of advice or a whole lot of...
Yeah, the whole copy shop mentality.
Yeah.
We can process.
Yeah,
sure,
exactly.
We can process.
Exactly.
Well, let's go into the... I like to separate the culling and from early case assessment, just because I think that's an area where people miscommunicate what early case assessment is. But let's talk about intelligently doing early case assessment, which... I'm going to define as really trying to understand your case and its attendant risks based on maybe a limited review of ESI and custodians and maybe some analytic tools. How does that play across risk aversion, or are we still too new with that?
I think we're pretty new with that. I mean, I think the fact that you had to define it first, Carl, I think cuts
so
me off on the first question.
Just lost at this point, okay? So, well, I'm not going to spend any money. What are you talking about?
Right. I mean, I think, whenever anybody says, do you have an early case assessment or what do you do for early case assessment, I hide the smirk on my face and say, well, what do you mean by early case assessment? And it's not because I'm a jerk and I just like to make people squirm, but frankly, people don't really know what that means all the time. As you've defined it, because I think it's a buzzword that doesn't always get a lot of meaning, but I think there is something to it. I mean, it's not a made-up term. I mean, it can mean something like you've suggested, Carl, analytics and, trying to really do analysis as opposed to review. And there, I think it is pretty early. I don't think there's a lot of standards. I think you'll have, some who can channel their inner geek really well and can do some pretty amazing things with data. I think it's probably more common in the investigative world than it is in the straight discovery world. I don't think we've quite crossed that bridge where people have readily accepted it. And I think lawyers just sometimes litigators don't move quickly enough. So from a risk aversion point of view, I think it's still early to tell. As long as it's not stopping potentially relevant evidence from making it downstream, I think we're okay and it's not really a risk issue. I think it's more about an efficiency. Ideally, one day we'll get to the point that we'll be able to do early case assessment, I think, in a way that will help us, really assess what a case is about early on and make some early settlement and trial decisions in days that we just never imagined that we could do.
Well, I'm doing a future podcast with the head of the Justice Department in Canada's e-discovery unit, and he's going to blow open the early casement and smart witness interviewing and using tools. So, you know, we're going to try to stay ahead of the curve on the show. But let's go back into the EDRM model step by step, A to Z. Okay, we'll go to the next step. Okay, review. You know, and deploying people or teams of attorneys to do review. And this is, of course, when the bills really start to add up. You know, clients react differently to what they're willing to pay. My sense is all clients feel this pain when they go this route. How do you see the breakdown of the three parties here?
Yeah, I think there's less risk of in review in terms of sanctions, certainly. You know, because I think in most cases, if you find that you've done a bad job in review, if you're not just on the eve of trial, you can probably get a redo. So I think the sanction risk is not so high. You haven't gotten rid of data. It's preserved. You just, maybe the review process was flawed. But the risk comes up, as you said, Carl, in terms of just cost. What is this going to cost us to do? And how good a job are we going to do in review? And I think we're still learning a lot in that area. I mean, we've certainly come a long way. There's a lot of options available to us today and clients. We can, I think we've moved to, you know, there's plenty of people who have used offshore review and found it can be effectively used and save a lot of money. There's certainly, we're starting to see more sort of intelligent review with some of the folks that, you know, there was a New York Times article recently, other places where we try to get sort of an automated review process, if you will, without, you know, at least on the bulk of stuff, without it, you know, humans reviewing everything. So I think that's an area to watch. Again, is that new stuff more risky? Yeah, a little bit. If you're always the first adopter, does that mean you shouldn't do it? No, but you should kind of know what risks you're taking. So I, you know, review is an interesting one. It's clearly the place you want to spend some energy understanding how you do it. And there are plenty of ways that I think people need to get better at to manage that review process.
Yeah, it's funny because I started in review and I've always kept track of it. And I remember going to conferences after I'd sold my company, and every vendor out there that the one particularly struck me, I think it was at Georgetown, I was explaining their tool and they basically said, yeah, and here's a tool, blah, 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 blah. And then you throw a bunch of contract attorneys in front of it. And I just felt like,
right.
Okay, you don't understand how to manage people.
Exactly.
Your tool's not going to do that. But anyway, I agree. I think the market's becoming a little bit more sophisticated. It's interesting.
I think you and I have talked about, you know, that how many judges have actually seen a review platform run? You know, what it really takes today. They remember when they did it in law firms and moved paper. There's lots of attorneys out there who really don't understand or haven't seen the mechanics of what an electronic review really looks like.
Yeah, it's not fun stuff.
No.
But it's real important.
Yeah, and so unless you've seen it, you really can't figure out what the right way to manage it is.
Yep.
So I think we're learning, we're continuing to learn in that area that and it's like you say, a lot of human sort of how do people react and how do you manage and motivate people.
So what are the challenges of counseling these different types of clients? I mean, you parachute it in. Do you have to get a feel for risk assessment right away, or?
I think you do. I think you need to have a discussion early on and understand, you know, talk out the, you know, the, what's this going to look like beginning to end. I don't think you can come in and just say, all right, now let's put on our collection blinders and identification blinders and let's talk about identification. Now let's talk about collection. I think you have to sit down and sort of say, look, where is this going to go? What's our volumes expected? What do we think this case is about? How much is the case worth? What's our opponent like? You know, how cooperative can we be? How cooperative, you know, are we going to be prevented from being? What's the court's reception? What's our timing? Because just the timing of a case can affect how you do things. I mean, if you've only got 6 months or you got a governmental investigation that really needs to happen in a couple of months, it's going to change your decisions, and risk will tie to that. So I think it's really important to sit down and have a discussion about what the overall e-discovery world is going to look like in the case. And I always say my objective, since I don't handle cases as a first chair anymore, my objective is to get in and get out as quickly as possible with the case and let things get back to the merits. Handle the e-discovery preservation, handle the collection, make sure we have things available for review, and then try to exit the case as quickly as possible. If I'm still in at the end, things haven't gone quite so swimmingly.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, you're sounding a heck of a lot like an insurance underwriter. You got this Midwest sort of thing going. You know, it's like the bad accident on TV. Who are you going to call? Type of a thing. But anyway, well, do you think the I feel lucky clients who push for limited preparation are doing this due to risk assessment, or do you think it's because litigation's a four-letter word for cost?
You know, I think some are, you know, delicately ignoring the real risk, and aren't, you know, just looking at cost alone and not appreciating the risk. I mean, you know, it goes again. We have to face facts: is that there's still lots of lawyers, litigators in the country. The vast majority can still say they've never been sanctioned, let alone from an e-discovery sanction. So it's an interesting question. You said the insurance thing, and I always say it's I would say it's a bit like selling disability insurance. Is that I remember when I first bought disability insurance in my 30s, and I thought, well, they explained to me how I was more likely to be disabled than die, and so once you get over that and you realize that, then it makes sense to address the risk. But if you're going to ignore the risk, then why would you ever solve it? And I think e-discovery is a bit like that. I mean, it's easy to say it's never happened to me, and I've talked to some of my friends, and it's never happened to them, and we all seem like good lawyers, and it does happen to good lawyers. So it's an interesting problem. I think a lot of them are ignoring the risk, and I think if you address the risk and just look at it, make some conscious decisions, I think everybody's happier in the end. I think you'll spend less money, frankly.
Yeah, well, I like to try to, you know, make this all neat and tidy here at the end. So what type of organization, Scott, typically pays the most for e-discovery services? Is it the feeling lucky people, or the middle, or the risk averse?
Well, I think over a long span, I think the people that it's a combination. The people that I feel lucky, I'm going to take my chances, and then they happen to have a major piece of litigation come in, they end up paying a lot of money to handle the e-discovery issues in that particular case, a cost they probably would have avoided if they'd spent a little bit of time on the front end. And it doesn't take a lot to just be mindful of the issues and reduce some costs. So I think the fire drill in a major case is never pretty, and it can cost a lot of money. So I think those people in the long run. But if they never, you know, the lottery ticket never comes in and they never actually hit that big case that they end up having to deal with, I suppose they save some money. But as soon as that first case, their ROI is going to disappear.
Yep. Well, Scott, this has been a really fun show. I appreciate you joining us here at ESI Bytes. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you and have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners. And I hope we're able to do some more shows with you later this year.
We will. We will.
Great. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, is Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.